I'm Caleb Brown, host of the Cato Daily Podcast. If you appreciate Cato's research and analysis, I'd like to ask you to financially support the Cato Daily Podcast and the broad mission of the Cato Institute to advance the ideals of individual liberty, limited government, free markets, and peace. If you support our mission by becoming a new Cato Podcast sponsor or renew your sponsorship with an increased gift, one generous sponsor will be matching your gift dollar for dollar. That will double your impact. Visit cato.org/podcast sponsor and support our work. This is the only time of the year when I make this request, so I'm adding something as well. If you support Cato to the tune of $1,000 or more, I will gladly give you a shout out on the podcast, or you can designate an individual to receive all the benefits of that donation. Just visit cato.org/podcast sponsor to get started. And thank you. This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Monday, December 21st, 2020. I'm Caleb Brown. When the software that runs your network that you trust to provide security is compromised, it's a very bad day. We may not learn for some time the extent of this likely Russian-led attack on American network security. Cato's Julian Sanchez describes what we do know now.
I think the full impact of this is going to take quite a while to fully assess. But what we know now is that supply chain attack, which I'll explain in a second, mounted by a very sophisticated adversary, attack has been widely attributed to Russian intelligence, was able to compromise a very widely used piece of network management software, the Orion package produced by a company called SolarWinds based out of Austin, Texas. So this is software that's used by enterprises to manage their computer networks, and is used by virtually everyone, by more than 400 of the Fortune 500 companies, by a huge number of government clients. This is called, of course, a supply chain attack, because the idea is to, if you want to do a bank heist that has, and they've got strong security, if you can infiltrate the company that makes the locks, you're going to have a much easier time getting in. In this case, you have these very secure networks. If you can infiltrate the companies that legitimately provide them with software, then you're able to essentially sneak inside the perimeter. And in the case of something like network management software, you have an in that is essentially a tool that already has some pretty high-level privileges. You know, when you think about apps on your phone, the operating system on your phone isn't going to let, a game that you download access the files that your email or your chats are in. The operating system controls the permissions that are available to different programs. But of course, if the operating system itself is compromised, then you can no longer rely on that. And of course, network management software, because it's sort of a fundamental layer on which the system runs, needs to have high privileges. And so that makes it a particularly dangerous piece of software to have compromised. This appears to have been pushed out between March and June of this year in updates. It looks like, although they have a huge number of clients, it seems like only about 18,000, well, only about 18,000 clients downloaded this infected software. This is about half of the installed user base of this particular package. And, you know, this is one of these perennial dilemmas here is, if you want software to be secure, it needs to be patched and updated regularly as new vulnerabilities and bugs are discovered all the time. But it also means you have this process of installing and having to trust that new update is legitimate. It's, you know, it's signed by the developer, and so you can trust the contents of this security update. And it appears that in this case, attackers were able to sneak some malicious code into one of those updates. What we now know is that a large number of government agencies, the State Department, the Commerce Department, Department of Homeland Security, parts of the Pentagon, have all been affected. Going back probably to about March. So we have a situation now where probably Russian foreign adversary has been inside the perimeter for something like 9 months now. Now, the cybersecurity infrastructure security agency sent out a directive, essentially ordering all federal agencies to pull this this compromised software. Which, one, is sort of easier said than done. This is not, you know, delete Angry Birds from your phone. This is you've got to pull the software that is managing the network. So it's not like you can just drag it to the trash bin and easy as pie. But also, you know, the first thing a sophisticated attacker does when they get into a network is try to establish persistence. That's, you know, tech jargon there, right? They try to ensure that if the initial access point is removed, is found and taken away from them, they have other routes back into the system. And so they've had quite a long time to establish a foothold and build other ways into the system. And incidentally, CISA has said that they believe there are other exploits that were used, so that this is a very complex and sophisticated operation that may not have relied on this one trick to get in.
So if you were in charge of a broad hack that had many thousands of potential victims, and you're working on behalf of a state actor, probably, where are the jewels? What's the stuff that you're going to go for when you get in?
Well, so fortunately, the most classified information is kept on separate segregated networks that are not supposed to be connected to the public internet or any computers that are connected to the public internet. So there's CyberNet, which is the Pentagon sort of network for information classified up to the secret level. And then there's a network called JWICS that's for the most highly classified information. That's the Joint Worldwide Intelligence Communication System. And these ought to be fully segregated so that compromising the unclassified systems would not allow them access to the classified systems. You have to hope that sort of firewall has been maintained. There are sort of various clever ways that folks have found to attempt to circumvent that kind of air gapping or segregation. But as far as we know at present, we're talking about compromise of unclassified networks. But there's still an enormous amount that you can potentially extract from that. So the correspondence of government officials, again, not necessarily classified at the time it's sent, but very often we find information is unclassified and later deemed classified. People don't always know at the time they're writing something whether it's going to be determined to be classified later. But also, just a lot of knowledge of the plans and practices of government agencies and personnel. Potentially information that might be embarrassing to individuals and open them to blackmail. Although you would hope people would learn enough not to send that kind of information on their government work network, but as we have learned over the past few years, not all government employees are so circumspect in their use of their government devices. So, that's certainly a concern. There appears to have been some interest in think tanks, interestingly enough, outside government. So, knock wood, and also some of the technology standard setting bodies within the Commerce Department seem to have been of interest. And that includes evaluations like what kinds of sort of cutting edge technology are permitted to be sold to foreign powers.
Aside from the sort of what seem to be obvious targets, perhaps there's opportunities for corporate espionage here as well?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Microsoft has reported that they detected the malware in some of their systems. We do know that, again, because even if the malware is itself on thousands of systems, the actually executing a penetration and extraction, if you're interested in keeping it stealthy and undetected, which is critical, means you can't sort of simultaneously attack all of the systems. So it seems like probably of the systems where the malware was installed, fewer than 1% actually then were actively compromised by a follow-up attack. It seems as though, for the most part, these other compromised systems checked in with a command and control system and were told, we don't need you right now. Just go dormant, go quiet. And again, that makes sense when you're prioritizing secrecy, because the more different entities you're attacking, the more additional risk you're assuming that one of those targets is going to detect the attack and then inform the others, at which point, of course, the game is up. But yeah, corporate entities seem to have also been on the list of targets. But it does look like, at least looking at the known targets at this point, the priority here does not seem to have been, stealing intellectual property from American companies. It looks like, again, governments and policy organizations were focused on in a way that again, suggests a government actor, certainly.
What can raise the cost of these kinds of attacks? It seems that there ought to be a greater focus on preventing precisely this kind of infiltration.
Right. And, this is a problem that is notoriously difficult to deal with via traditional deterrence, just because the value to the attacker of a successful penetration is usually so great that it's going to outweigh a punishment or a sanction that the defender can credibly threaten. So we could say we're going to drop nuclear bombs if you do this again, but no one, I think, really believes that we would in fact do that. We've heard, I think, some politicians talking very loosely about this as an act of war or like a digital Pearl Harbor. But ultimately, this is espionage. And traditionally, espionage has not been seen as an act of war. It's been understood as something that states do to each other, that we certainly do to other countries pretty promiscuously. And we, at some level, expect them to do to us. And that, it's not traditionally been seen as something that provokes a kinetic response. We talk about Russia. Well, we've already hit them with some hefty sanctions. So, there is this question of, well, is this something that is effectively deterrable? And it might be, but we would need to develop a new set of norms and understandings about what the range of responses are. Part of the problem is an attribution problem. So we believe this is Russia. We haven't seen sort of the public evidence, but it seems pretty plausible that that's an accurate assessment. But the question becomes, well, if you're going to take retaliatory action, not necessarily military action, but some kind of retaliatory action, what's the level of certainty you have about the attribution of the attack? One thing that the attackers in this case seem to have done as part of that sophistication is they used U.S.-based infrastructure to mount the attack. So you don't suddenly have Homeland Security computers shoving huge amounts of data out to a server in Ukraine, which might raise a red flag. But so you have these problems of attribution, which is, all right, are you sure enough about the origins of this that you are prepared to act in a punitive way based on that? But also just the question of, well, is there a punishment that you can impose, especially on countries that are already maybe not in our good books, that is proportionate, that's not going to be seen by the international community as wildly unreasonable, but is also going to be sufficient to outweigh the enormous value to the attacker of having all this very valuable information. So the other side is, of course, defense, and it is just a kind of inherent difficulty of modern cybersecurity when it comes to this kind of attack, that any complex network of any significant size is going to need to be running a lot of software that was not produced in-house. You actually probably wouldn't trust software that was sort of exclusively produced by the government, right? You probably have dozens or hundreds of different vendors, if not thousands of different vendors, who are producing software that's running on that network. And so you don't just have to worry about your own defenses, but at some level about their defenses. And so that does create an enormous difficulty. And obviously we're seeing the results of it now. I think, you know, one question that is going to have to be explored is how was this achieved, right? How is it that code that had been altered by an attacker was then signed by essentially a security company, you know, a company that is producing software that is in part meant to secure networks, no one in that process realized that the code that they were shipping was different from, you know, the code their people had written.
Anybody who's worked in a corporate setting and gone through the basic good practices as a user of the internet. Kevin Mitnick, of course, is somebody who's now well known as being somebody who provides that kind of training to organizations after being a notorious hacker. That doesn't seem like this attack at all.
Right. No, I mean, the advice you will always hear, or the instructions you'll hear in, a corporate orientation or a orientation for a government agency are, well, you know, be careful about, you know, what links you click on. Don't download, don't install something you aren't sure of the provenance of. And a good system administrator will basically make it as difficult as possible for the user to make a mistake. They will not allow you to install on the company or agency network software that is not approved. But this was software that was approved and was legitimate. In a way, this is not that different from an attack the U.S. government itself used in deploying the Stuxnet virus. We essentially used some stolen credentials to authenticate our code as being legitimately issued by a company that was, supposed to be having software installed on the systems that it infected. This was used to target Iran's nuclear program some years ago. And that's of course why companies, developers normally sort of reserve their highest level of security for their own signing keys, for the cryptographic keys that authenticate a piece of software as really having come from Microsoft or Apple or whoever the developer is. And usually those are kept sort of air-gapped and with, again, fairly elaborate hardware-based security so that you need someone sort of physically there at a device to activate the process of signing code as authenticated from the developer. One of the questions that obviously SolarWinds is going to have to answer is, well, what went wrong? Because it's one thing to say someone got into your system, that happens, and was tinkering around, but how is it that they got in, changed the code, and then there's no process that detected that before someone took the step of signing and authenticating that code?
Julian Sanchez is a senior fellow at the Cato Institute. Subscribe to the Cato Daily Podcast anywhere you please, and follow us on Twitter @CatoPodcast.